Lecture 23, The Right to Silence.
In this lecture, we conclude our sprint through the First Amendment by considering a question that is, perhaps, a little unusual. It's certainly not the ordinary kind of question one would approach or consider in this kind of a course. That question is simply this: does the First Amendment include a right not to speak? We'll consider a number of different versions of this question. We'll first take it up with the Supreme Court case of Talley versus California, decided in 1960, where the court considered the problem of anonymous speech. Then we will move quickly to the court's two flag salute cases, among the most important and controversial cases decided in the 20th century. And we'll conclude with a more recent case, Woolley versus Maynard, decided in 1977. Before we get to those cases, however, which, as I mentioned, are extremely controversial and will require a great deal of our attention, it might be the appropriate time now to think about where we have been so far. We began our study of the First Amendment by considering the different kinds of rationales and justifications that rest behind our commitment to freedom of speech. We saw that there are many reasons why we might choose to protect speech, and we saw also that many of those reasons are extraordinarily complex. We then moved quickly to a series of discussions about more specific First Amendment problems, such as the problem of illegal advocacy, or pornography, or obscenity. And we saw that no matter what the specific issue involved, there were always two or three basic themes that were present. The first of those, I think we might describe as the problem of definition. In other words, we were concerned to ask, what is speech? What's protected? What isn't protected? And why? Secondarily, we were concerned with trying to decide and to examine what kinds of tools the court has at its disposal to decide such issues. So to some extent, of course, we had to discuss precedent, and also we had to discuss the various kinds of doctrinal devices that the court has managed to construct over the last century or so. We saw, as we have often seen, that those doctrines themselves are very complex, but their complexity does not mean necessarily that they lead easily or inevitably to simple conclusions. Thirdly, we considered more generally the relationship between individual freedom and the various kinds of social or collective interests that sometimes seem to conflict with speech. As we have seen with speech and with every other liberty we have so far considered, no right is ever absolute. There are always conflicts between other kinds of constitutional values, in this case, constitutional values such as dignity, for example, or equality, that will sometimes conflict with our commitment to speech. And then finally, we considered an issue that is, again, hardly unique to our First Amendment inquiry. When should judges, if ever, choose to defer to the democratic process in valuing, I should say, in balancing these various kinds of constitutional interests and constitutional liberties? That issue, which I think we might call the issue of decisional authority, where does decisional authority rest, is an issue highlighted by the cases in today's lecture. Let's begin, as I suggested, with the court's decision in Talley versus California, again decided in 1960. Now, Talley is not as well known as many of the cases we will consider, but it does provide for a very interesting set of little problems. In this case, the court considered the constitutionality of a Los Angeles ordinance that restricted the distribution of anonymous handbills and flyers. The plaintiffs in Talley challenged that prohibition on anonymous flyers. In this case, they had distributed handbills, urging a boycott of various merchants who had allegedly discriminated against their employees on the basis of race. The court ruled for the plaintiffs, noting that a requirement of identification, in other words, the prohibition on anonymity, would tend in the abstract and also in the concrete case to restrict speech. And the rationale here, I think, is very interesting. Justice Black wrote, and I quote, "Persecuted groups and sects from time to time throughout history have been able to criticize either anonymously or not at all." Now, before we move off of Talley, I think it's important that we understand the rationale behind the majority's opinion. The idea here is that anonymity makes it possible in some instances for individuals to speak. There is an individual interest that we mean to protect here, but there is also a social interest. All I mean by that is simply that Justice Black, again writing for the court, seemed to understand that society has a value in hearing certain kinds of speech that might not otherwise make it to the marketplace if we insist upon identifying the speaker. He certainly has a point here. But I think it's probably also important to think about what kinds of communal or social interests might have rested behind the Los Angeles decision to prohibit anonymous speech. That perhaps is not so easy to do. One might imagine, for example, that there was a littering interest. We don't want, as a city or as a community, thousands of handbills and flyers littering our streets. But that hardly seems enough of an interest to justify whatever the potential restriction is on speech. Could the state, or in this case, could the city have come up with another rationale for why it would prohibit anonymous speech? Well, perhaps not with regard to this particular law, or at least to this particular factual situation. But in the abstract, there might be perfectly good reasons why the state might sometimes want speech not to be anonymous. What might those reasons be? Well, if one of the social values we want to protect would be the dignity of other human beings, or the civility of social discourse, one might argue that anonymity, while it sometimes makes other kinds of speech possible that we would not otherwise have the opportunity to hear, also might encourage irresponsibility. And one of the few things that we have failed to cover in this course is the possibility that constitutional liberties might somehow be associated also with constitutional responsibilities. It might be the case, in other words, that the prohibition on anonymity cleanses the public sphere and makes speech or imposes upon speech a certain kind of responsibility, and that might not be such a terrible social interest. Talley, however, as I suggested, is not among the better known of Supreme Court cases, and the issue it raised in particular has not come up that often. I propose now that we turn to two other cases that are much better known, and which, at least at first appearance, seem to have much more significance for our day-to-day lives. I should add that these two cases, as I mentioned before, are extraordinarily controversial. In part, they are controversial because the court rarely, if ever, reverses itself in the span of 3 years. But this court did with these two cases. And for that reason alone, they are important and significant. But the underlying issues are issues that as Americans, all of us at some point wrestle with. And if you pay any attention to current politics, you will recognize in these cases hints of controversies to come. Let me begin with the first of these two cases, Minersville versus Gobitis, decided in 1940. Minersville involved the constitutionality of the flag salute as an exercise of the state's police power. And you will recall that the police power is the power of the state to protect the health, safety, welfare, and morals of the community. Minersville is a tiny little town located in Coal Country, Pennsylvania. And in the late 1930s, remember we are on the cusp of World War II, in the late 1930s, America was overcome, or at least we could say that Minersville was overcome, with a profound concern for the promotion of patriotism. The Minersville School Board, and later its city council, reacted to this concern by requiring children to say the Pledge of Allegiance and to salute the flag every morning. Now, to some of you, that may seem perfectly innocuous. Before you reach that conclusion, it might be well to remember that the pledge that these children spoke is not precisely the same pledge that school children today make in the morning. Nor is the flag salute precisely the same kind of flag salute that I at least learned as a child. As far as I know, the flag salute that is said by millions of children every day involves the placing of one's hand over one's heart. That is not the flag salute that the Gobitis children, members of the Jehovah's Witness religion, were asked to perform. They were asked to perform a different kind of flag salute. It wasn't different at the time. I mean, it was different than our own. The flag salute required in Minersville was the same flag salute that was required by 1,000 other school districts in the United States. And that flag salute involved the upraising of one's right hand, palm open, and the recitation of the pledge. Now, many of us, of course, will have an instinctive kind of emotional reaction to that particular pledge because it seems deeply reminiscent of pledges we associate, for example, with Nazi Germany. We do not need the benefit of 40 or 50 years of hindsight to make that connection. Even at that time, there were objections to the flag salute based on precisely those grounds. The Jehovah's Witness Church, for example, objected in part because the gesture seemed too eerily similar to these other kinds of gestures. And more generally, the Jehovah's Witnesses, in this case, the Gobitis family, objected to the flag salute because it seemed to them to violate a basic principle of their religious faith that thou shalt not worship a graven image. Writing for the majority, Justice Frankfurter agreed, quote, that every possible leeway should be given to claims of religious faith. Nevertheless, he upheld the requirements, noting, and again I quote, the state's interest is inferior to none. National unity is the basis of national security. Frankfurter also struck a familiar chord about the necessity for judicial deference to legislative authority as a central feature of democratic self-governance. And as I reminded you at the beginning of this lecture, that is a recurrent theme, not only in Justice Frankfurter's jurisprudence, but in the jurisprudence of civil liberties more generally. I could, of course, go on at great length about this decision. I could, as I have done so many times, try to parse it sentence by sentence and tell you the various kinds of academic criticisms that one might address against Felix Frankfurter's opinion. I don't think it's necessary to do that here. I would prefer to concentrate on the larger social and political reaction to the court's opinion. Within 2 weeks of Minersville, think about that, within 2 weeks of Minersville, the Department of Justice received hundreds of reports. Hundreds of reports of violence directed against members of the Jehovah's Witness faith. Some of those reports, as awful as it sounds, involved the lynching of Jehovah's Witnesses, and there are even recorded cases of castration directed against Jehovah's Witnesses. What an extraordinary reaction. How do we explain such a reaction? I am not confident of any explanation that I could offer you. I don't think the court's decision caused such violence. Before I reached that conclusion, I would want to know, for example, how much violence, if any, had been directed against Jehovah's Witnesses before the decision. Perhaps it seemed to a community, deeply concerned about the possibility of war, deeply concerned about the state of the nation's sense of pride and patriotism, perhaps Jehovah's Witnesses would have come in for violence in any event. But clearly, something about the court's decision seemed to spark, or at least add to, this sense of outrage directed against members of this particular faith. Just 2 years later, in 1942, three justices, in a case unrelated, really, to Minersville, called Jones versus Opelika, 1942, those three justices were Justices Black, Douglas, and Murphy, announced that they had erred in Gobitis. Now, we have not spent a great deal of time in this course talking about the niceties of the Supreme Court's jurisdiction. But it is a truism amongst scholars and judges that courts are passive, reactive institutions. Unlike Congress, which can charge a hearing whenever it wants to consider any pressing social problem. Unlike the president, who can command the airwaves at his own initiative, the court may only react to cases that are brought to it. That is the truism. This case, however, suggests that while the court may have to wait for others to act, it can at least prod them into action. The dissent, or I should say the opinion by Black, Douglas, and Murphy that they had aired in Minersville was, of course, an open invitation for somebody else to bring a case that would give the court an opportunity to reconsider its decision. That opportunity came about in the case of West Virginia versus Barnett, decided in 1943. Now, again in Barnett, we have a statute that requires the recitation of the pledge and that flag salute that I described to you earlier, this flag salute, palm in the air, hands raised, stiff-armed. This statute, however, if possible, went even further than the statute in Minersville by providing that any child who failed to comport with this requirement would be suspended, then expelled, and once expelled, found to be a truant, whereupon his parents could be fined, or her parents might actually be sent to jail. This is compulsion, of course, of the highest order. I don't mean to denigrate that. It might be a kind of compulsion that is perfectly constitutional, or at least that is what the court had suggested in Minersville. This time, however, the court changed its mind. And there are a number of opinions we need to consider here, or that we could consider at least, but the two most important are the majority opinion by Justice Jackson and the inevitable dissent by Felix Frankfurter. One word about Justice Jackson, because I don't believe we have encountered him up to this point in the course. As you read his opinion, you may want to remember that it is 1943 and that later Justice Jackson will become the chief prosecutor at the Nuremberg war trials. He begins in Barnett by saying, and I quote, "One's right to life, liberty, and property, to free speech, a free press, freedom of worship and assembly, and other fundamental rights may not be submitted to vote. They depend on the outcome of no election." What an extraordinary claim, fundamentally at odds, you can probably see, with the kind of claim made by Felix Frankfurter, writing for a majority in Minersville. Jackson continues, "The freedoms asserted by these appellees does not bring them into collision with rights asserted by any other individual. Nor is there any question in this case that their behavior is peaceable and orderly. The sole conflict is between authority and the rights of the individual." I think it's important to stop here for a moment, although we are hardly done with Jackson's opinion. That last sentence I quoted to you suggests that the sole conflict, he wrote, is between authority and the rights of the individual. And surely it is possible to describe the conflict in West Virginia versus Barnett or the conflict in Minersville in precisely those terms. But that is not the only way to describe what happened in this case. One might rewrite that sentence to make it read, "The sole conflict is between the community and the rights of the individual." Because let us not forget that it is the community's interest in the promotion of a spirit of patriotism that is the genesis behind this statute, behind this requirement. Does the Constitution inevitably tell us, is there anything in the First Amendment that tells us without ambiguity how to resolve a conflict between the individual and the community? It will not do simply to describe it in those terms. One needs to resolve it in those terms. Here is how Justice Jackson tried to get at that problem. And again, I quote, "The very purpose of a Bill of Rights was to withdraw certain subjects from the vicissitudes of political controversy to place them beyond the reach of majorities. Now think about the importance of that claim. In trying to reconcile this problem between the community's interest and the individual liberty, in trying to resolve the problem that I called the problem of decisional authority just a little earlier in this lecture, Justice Jackson does not so much depend upon the language or the meaning even of the First Amendment, but instead counsels us to look at the entire purpose of the Bill of Rights writ large. And in so doing, he suggests that there is inevitably always a tension between our commitment to liberty and our commitment to democratic self-governance. But that tension must be resolved, he says, by understanding that the whole point of the Bill of Rights was to withdraw certain subjects from the political arena. Now, he doesn't actually say this, but I think it is a fair interpretation of his position to suggest that in trying to reconcile liberty with community, we must understand that that is not necessarily an even-handed contest. It is a prejudiced contest. I mean, prejudiced in the sense that we must start from an assumption that at least with regard to those liberties contained in the Bill of Rights, we should err on the side of protecting liberty, because that is the whole idea, the very central purpose of the Bill of Rights itself. And then Justice Jackson concludes. The case, he wrote, is made difficult not because the principles of its decision are obscure, but because the flag involved is our own. Now, surely he must have a point here. Surely there is a kind of emotional baggage that handicaps our ability to take a look at this problem objectively. He adds to that, and I will paraphrase here, that one of the central purposes of the Bill of Rights is to protect a freedom of liberty more generally. And that freedom to differ will not be worth much if the freedom to differ is limited to items or to matters or to ideas that do not much matter themselves. We must, if we are to take liberty seriously, protect the liberty to differ in areas that strike to the very core of our social being, of who we are as a people. I might add that he claims the case is made difficult not because the principles of its decision are obscure. That is certainly true. The principles of the decision are not obscure at all. But I think the case is made difficult for more reasons than the one he advances alone, that the flag involved is our own. I think the case is made difficult because it is not perhaps as obvious to some people as it was to Jackson that in reconciling these two liberties, one is clearly of greater significance than the other. I think reasonable people might disagree about how to strike that balance. Certainly Justice Frankfurter disagreed about how to strike the balance. Now, at the point of being too repetitive, I can't stress enough that we are only 3 years past Minersville, and that it was Justice Frankfurter who had written the majority opinion in Minersville. His dissent in Barnett is impassioned. He begins, "One who belongs to the most vilified and persecuted minority in history is not likely to be insensitive to the freedoms guaranteed by our Constitution." I want to stop here. Justice Frankfurter is referring, of course, to his Jewish heritage. One might wonder, I know that I always do, why he feels compelled to open with such a personal statement. One who belongs to the most vilified and persecuted minority in history is not likely to be insensitive to the freedoms guaranteed by our Constitution. Surely at some point, Frankfurter must have felt as though he had been criticized, unfairly perhaps, as being insensitive to the needs of these poor children or to the violence directed against Jehovah's Witnesses more generally. He continues, "Were my purely personal attitude relevant, I should wholeheartedly associate myself with the general libertarian views in the court's opinion." Why tell us that? Why does it matter what his personal opinion would be? Justice Frankfurter has a lesson he wants us to learn. And that lesson, as we have seen before, is that there is a difference between a judge's appeal to his or her own personal identity or personal set of beliefs and their obligation to interpret the Constitution. And Frankfurter tells us in hauntingly personal terms that there are times where the Constitution has taken him, as indeed it must take every interpreter, to places that he would rather not go. That there is a sharp divide, and in this case, obviously, an emotionally painful divide between what he thinks the Constitution commands him to do and what he would like to do. He continues, reinforcing this theme. "But as judges, we are neither Jew nor Gentile, neither Catholic nor agnostic." He does not, as it turns out, invoke the image of the blind statue of justice with the scales being weighted on either side. But that might have been the image that he could have used. Justice is blind, or we should say, justice is agnostic. He wants to point to an image of a Supreme Court justice that brings to the decision no personal prejudice, no personal opinion, a human being, a blank slate, a perfectly objective, a perfectly sterile interpreter of the Constitution. And in some ways, that may be a noble ideal. Certainly, it is an ideal that has motivated justices, at least since Lochner, if not since the beginning of the Western legal system. And I suppose one might respond that that kind of dispassion, even if it is a constitutional ideal, might sometimes blind us, hence the blindfold, and it might be an exceptionally high price to pay. And let's think about who might pay that price. Clearly, Frankfurter paid a price. You can see the emotional turmoil that he is engulfed in. But let's not forget, too, that the Gobitis children had to pay that price. And lots of other children had to pay that price. Perhaps that is a price we all pay for living in a constitutional democracy. I hope you can see why these two cases are controversial, but if not, let me add to them one final point. They underscore for us yet again how difficult it is to determine when it is that judges should step in and set aside a decision reached by the majoritarian process. Stripped of all the emotion, stripped of all the facts, that is the underlying issue in the two flag salute cases. When, if ever, should judges set aside a result or a decision reached by legislatures? And unfortunately, the Constitution gives us no clear guidance as to that issue. Now, let me finish with just one other quick case. It's a fun case, I think, but a significant one. In Woolley versus Maynard, decided in 1977, the court ruled that the state of New Hampshire could not prosecute an individual who had masked over the phrase, "live free or die," on the license plate of his car. In this case, Woolley involved a Jehovah's Witness who objected to that phrase. In writing for the court, Chief Justice Berger did what you undoubtedly would have done. He compared the case to Barnett, noting, and I quote, "Here, as in Barnett, we are faced with a state measure which forces an individual as part of his daily life, indeed constantly while his automobile is in public view, to be an instrument for fostering public adherence to an ideological point of view he finds unacceptable." And that is why I have called these cases the right to silence cases, because there may be times when our right to silence is every bit as important in validating First Amendment values as our right to speak.